Have you heard anything about Sephara? Theramin asked.
Nothing. Why?
I'd like to find her.
She may have gone to Umgando too. If she met up with Bine somewhere along the way, he would have told her where everybody is going and...
Do you have any reason to think that might have happened?
It's only a guess.
Theramin said, My guess is that she's still somewhere around here. I want to try to track her down.
But the odds against that...
You found me, didn't you?
Oh, purely by accident. The chances that you'd be able to locate her the same way...
Are pretty good, Theramin said, or so I prefer to believe. I'm going to attempt it anyway. I can always hope to get to Umgando later on, with Sephara. Chiron gave him an odd look, but said nothing. Theramin said, You think I'm crazy? Well, maybe I am.
I didn't say that, but I think you're risking your neck for nothing. This place is turning into a prehistoric jungle. It's become absolute savagery here, and not getting any better as the days go along from what I've seen. Come south with me, Theramin. We can be out of here in 2 or 3 hours, and the road to Umgando is just...
I mean to look for Sephara first, said Theramin obstinately.
Forget her.
I don't intend to do that. I'm going to stay here and search for her. Chiron shrugged.
Stay then. I'm clearing out. I saw Imat cut down by a little girl, remember? Right before my eyes. No more than 200 yards from here. This place is too dangerous for me.
And you think going on a hike of 300 or 400 miles all by yourself isn't dangerous? The psychologist hefted his hatchet.
I've got this if I need it.
Theramin fought back laughter. Chiron was so absurdly mild-mannered that the thought of him defending himself with a hatchet was impossible to take seriously. He said after a moment, Lots of luck.
You really intend to stay?
Until I find Sephara. Chiron stared sadly at him.
Keep the luck you just offered me, then. I think you'll need it more than I will.
He turned and trudged away without another word. 34. For 3 days, or perhaps it was 4, the time went by like a blur, Sephara moved southward through the forest. She had no plan except to stay alive. There was no point in even trying to get back to her apartment. The city still seemed to be burning. A low curtain of smoke hung in the air wherever she looked, and occasionally she saw a sinuous tongue of red flame licking into the sky on the horizon. It appeared to her as if new fires were being started every day, which meant that the craziness had not yet begun to abate. She could feel her own mind returning gradually to normal, clearing day by day, blessedly emerging into clarity as though she were awakening from some terrible fever. She was uncomfortably aware that she wasn't fully herself yet. Managing any sequence of thoughts was a laborious thing for her, and she lost herself quickly in a muddle. But she was on her way back, of that she was sure. Apparently, many of the others around her in the forest weren't recovering at all. Though Sephara was trying to keep to herself as much as she could, she encountered people from time to time, and most of them looked pretty badly deranged, sobbing, moaning, laughing wildly, glaring weirdly, rolling over and over on the ground. Just as Chiron had suggested, some had suffered such mental trauma during the time of the crisis that they might never be sane again. Huge segments of the population must have lapsed into barbarism or worse, Sephara realized. They must be setting fires for the sheer fun of it now, or killing for the same reason. So she moved carefully. With no particular destination in mind, she drifted more or less southward across the forest, camping wherever she found fresh water. The club that she had picked up on the evening of the eclipse was never very far from her hand. She ate whatever she could find that looked edible. Seeds, nuts, fruits, even leaves and bark. It wasn't much of a diet. She knew that she was strong enough physically to endure a week or so on such improvised rations, but after that, she'd begin to suffer. Already she could feel what little extra weight she had been carrying dropping away, and her physical resilience beginning little by little to diminish. And the supply of berries and fruits was diminishing too, very rapidly as the forest's thousands of hungry new inhabitants picked it over. Then, on what she believed was the 4th day, Sephara remembered about the sanctuary. Her cheeks flamed as she realized that there had been no need for her to have been living this cavewoman life all week. Of course, how could she have been so stupid? Just a few miles from here at this very moment, hundreds of university people were tucked away safe and sound in the old particle accelerator lab, drinking bottled water and dining pleasantly on the canned foods that they had spent the last few months stashing away. How ridiculous to be skulking around in this forest full of madmen, scratching in the dirt for her meager meals, and looking hungrily at the little forest creatures that cavorted beyond her reach on the branches of trees. She would go to the sanctuary. Somehow there would be a way to get them to take her in. It was a measure of the extent to which the stars had disrupted her mind, she told herself, that it had taken her as long as this to remember that the sanctuary was there. Too bad, she thought, that the idea hadn't occurred to her earlier. She realized now that she had spent the last few days traveling in precisely the wrong direction. Directly ahead of her now lay the steep chain of hills that marked the southern boundary of the forest. Looking up, she could see the blackened remains of the posh Onos Heights real estate development along the summit of the hill that rose like a dark wall before her. The sanctuary, if she remembered correctly, was the opposite way entirely, midway between the campus and Sorrow City on the highway running along the north side of the forest. It took her another day and a half to make her way back through the forest to the north side. In the course of the journey, she had to use her club twice to fight off attackers. She had three non-violent but edgy staring matches with young men sizing her up to decide whether she could be jumped. And once she blundered into a sheltered copse where five gaunt, wild-eyed men with knives were stalking one another in a circle, like dancers moving in some strange archaic ritual. She got away from there as fast as she could. Finally, she saw the wide highway that was University Road ahead of her, just beyond the forest boundary. Somewhere along the north side of that road was the unobtrusive little country lane that led to the sanctuary. Yes, there it was, hidden, insignificant, bordered on both sides by untidy clumps of weeds and thick grass that had gone to seed. It was late afternoon. Onos was almost gone from the sky, and the hard, baleful light of Tano and Setha cast sharp shadows across the land that gave the day a wintry look, though the air was mild. The little red eye that was Dovim moved through the northern heavens, still very distant, still very high. Sephara wondered what had become of the unseeable Kalgash II. Evidently, it had done its terrible work and moved on. By this time, it might be a million miles out in space, curving away from the world on its long orbit, riding on and on through the airless dark, not to return for another 2,049 years. Which would be at least 2 million years too soon, thought Sephara bitterly. A sign appeared before her. Private property. No trespassing. By order of Board of Proctors, Sorrow University. And then a second sign in vivid scarlet. Danger. High energy research facility. No entry. Good. She must be going the right way then. Sephara had never been to the sanctuary, even in the days when it had still been a physics laboratory, but she knew what to expect. A series of gates, and then some sort of scanner post that would monitor anyone who had managed to get this far. Within minutes, she had come to the first gate. It was a double-hinged screen of tightly woven metal mesh, rising to perhaps twice her height, with a formidable-looking barbed wire fence stretching off at either end and disappearing into the brambled underbrush that grew uncontrollably here. The gate was ajar. She studied it, puzzled. Some illusion? Some trick of her muddled mind? No, the gate was open all right, and it was the correct gate. She saw the university security symbol on it, but why was it open? There was no indication that it had been forced. Troubled now, she went through. The road inward was nothing more than a dirt track, deeply rutted and cratered. She followed along its edge, and in a little while she saw an inner barrier. No mere barbed wire fence here, but a solid concrete wall, blank, impregnable looking. It was broken only by a gateway of dark metal with a scanner mounted above it. And this gate was open, too. Stranger and stranger. What about all the vaunted protection that was supposed to have sealed the sanctuary away from the general madness that had overtaken the world? She stepped inside. Everything was very quiet here. Ahead of her lay some scruffy-looking wooden sheds and barns. Perhaps the sanctuary entrance itself, the mouth of an underground tunnel, Sephara knew, lay behind them. She walked around the outbuildings. Yes, there was the sanctuary entrance, an oval door in the ground with a dark passageway behind it. And there were people, too, a dozen or so of them, standing in front of it, watching her with chilly, unpleasant curiosity. They all had strips of bright green cloth tied about their throats, as a kind of neckerchief. She didn't recognize any of them. So far as she could tell, they weren't university people. A small bonfire was burning just to the left of the door. Beside it was a pile of chopped logs, elaborately stacked, every piece of wood very neatly arranged according to size, with astonishing precision and care. It looked more like some sort of meticulous architect's model than a woodpile. A sickening sense of fear and disorientation swept over her. What was this place? Was it really the sanctuary? Who were these people? "Stay right where you are," said the man at the front of the group. He spoke quietly, but there was a whip-snapping authority in his tone. "Put your hands in the air." He held a small, sleek needle gun in his hand. It was pointing straight at her midsection. Safira obeyed without a word. He appeared to be about 50 years old, a strong, commanding figure, almost certainly the leader here. His clothing looked costly, and his manner was poised and confident. The green neckerchief he wore had the sheen of fine silk.
"Who are you?"
he asked calmly, keeping the weapon trained on her. "Safira 89, Professor of Archaeology, Saro University."
"That's nice. Are you planning to do any archaeology around here, Professor?"
The others laughed as though he had said something very, very funny. Safira said, "I'm trying to find the university sanctuary. Can you tell me where it is?"
"I think this might have been it," the man replied.
"The university people all cleared out of here a few days back. This is Fire Patrol headquarters now. Tell me, are you carrying any combustibles, Professor?"
"Combustibles?"
"Matches, lighter, a pocket generator, anything that could be used to start a fire." She shook her head. "Not any of those things. Fire starting's prohibited under Article 1 of the Emergency Code. If you're in violation of Article 1, the punishment is severe."
Safira stared at him blankly. What was he talking about?
A thin, sallow-faced man standing beside the leader said,
"I don't trust her, Altenal. It was those professors that started all this. 2-1, she's got something hidden away in her clothes, out of sight somewhere."
"I have no fire-making equipment anywhere on me," Safira said, irritated. Altenal nodded.
"Perhaps, perhaps not. We won't take the chance, Professor. Strip."
She stared at him, startled.
"What did you say?"
"Strip. Remove your clothes. Demonstrate that you have no concealed illegal devices anywhere on your person." Safira hefted her club, rubbing her hand uneasily along its shaft. Blinking in astonishment, she said,
"Hold on here. You can't be serious.
Article 2 of the Emergency Code, Fire Patrol may take any precaution deemed necessary to prevent unauthorized fire starting. Article 3, this may include immediate and summary execution of those who resist Fire Patrol authority. Strip, Professor, and do it quickly."
He gestured with the needle gun. It was a very serious-looking gesture. But still she stared at him. Still she made no move to remove her garments.
"Who are you? What's this Fire Patrol stuff all about?"
"Citizen vigilantes, Professor. We're attempting to restore law and order in Saro after the breakdown. The city's been pretty much destroyed, you know. Or maybe you don't. The fires are continuing to spread, and there's no functioning fire department to do anything about it anymore. And maybe you people haven't noticed, but the whole province is full of crazy people who think we haven't quite had enough fires yet as it is. So they're starting even more. That can't go on. We intend to stop the starters by any means available. You are under suspicion of possessing combustibles. The accusation has been placed, and you have 60 seconds to clear yourself of the charge. If I were you, I'd start getting my clothes off, Professor."
Safira could see him silently counting off the seconds. Strip? In front of a dozen strangers? A red haze of fury surged through her at the thought of the indignity. Most of these people were men. They weren't even bothering to hide their impatience. This wasn't any sort of security precaution, despite Altenal's solemn citing of an emergency code. They just wanted to see what her body looked like, and they had the power to make her submit. It was intolerable. But then, after a moment, she found her indignation beginning to slip away. What did it matter? Safira asked herself wearily. The world had ended. Modesty was a luxury that only civilized people indulged in, and civilization was an obsolete concept. In any case, this was a blunt order at gunpoint. She had wandered into a remote, isolated place far down a country road. No one was going to come and rescue her here. The clock was ticking, and Altenal didn't seem to be bluffing. It wasn't worth dying just for the sake of concealing her body from them. She tossed her club to the ground. Then, in cold anger, but without permitting herself to make any outward show of rage, she began methodically to peel away her garments and drop them down beside it.
"My underwear, too?" she asked sardonically. "Everything."
"Does it look as if I've got a lighter hidden in here?"
You've got 20 seconds left, Professor.
Zephyra glowered at him and finished undressing without another word. It was surprisingly easy, now that she had done it, to stand naked in front of these strangers. She didn't care. That was the essential thing that came with the end of the world, she realized. She didn't care. She pulled herself up to her full imposing height and stood there, almost defiantly revealed, waiting to see what they'd do next. Altenall's eyes traveled over her body in an easy, self-assured way. Somehow she found herself not even caring about that. A kind of burned-out indifference had come over her.
"Very nice, Professor," he said finally.
"Thank you." Her tone was icy. "May I cover myself now?" He waved grandly.
"Of course. Sorry for the inconvenience, but we had to be absolutely sure."
He slipped the needle gun into a band at his waist and stood with his arms folded, casually watching her as she dressed. Then he said,
"You must think you've fallen in among savages, isn't that so, Professor?"
"Does what I think really interest you?"
"You'll notice that we didn't leer or drool or wet our clothes while you were demonstrating that you had no concealed fire-making apparatus, nor did anyone attempt to molest you in any way."
"That was extremely kind."
Altenall said, "I point these things out even though I realize it's not likely to make much difference to you while you're still this angry at us, because I want you to know that what you've stumbled across here may in fact be the last remaining bastion of civilization in this godforsaken world. I don't know where our beloved governmental leaders have disappeared to, and I certainly don't consider our cherished brethren of the Apostles of Flame to be in any way civilized, and your university friends, who used to be hidden out here, have picked up and gone away. Just about everybody else seems to be clear out of his mind, except, that is, for you and us, Professor."
"How flattering of you to include me."
"I never flatter anybody. You give an appearance of having withstood the darkness and the stars and the breakdown better than most. What I want to know is whether you're interested in staying here and becoming part of our group. We need people like you, Professor."
"What does that mean? Scrub floors for you? Cook soup?" Altenall seemed impervious to her sarcasms.
"I mean helping in the struggle to keep civilization alive, Professor. Not to sound too high-pitched about it, but we see ourselves as having a holy mission. Day after day, we're making our way through that madhouse out there, disarming the crazies, taking the fire-making apparatus away from them, reserving to ourselves exclusively the right to light fires. We can't put the fires out that are already burning, at least not yet, but we can do our best to keep new ones from being lit. That's our mission, Professor. We are taking control of the concept of fire. It's the first step toward making the world fit to live in again. You seem sane enough to join us, and therefore I invite you in. What do you say, Professor? Do you want to be part of the fire patrol? Or would you rather try your luck back there in the forest?"
35. The morning was misty and cool. Thick swirls of fog blew through the ruined streets, fog so heavy that Sheeran was unable to tell which suns were in the sky. Onos, certainly, somewhere, but its golden light was diffused and almost completely concealed by the fog, and that patch of slightly brighter sky off to the southwest very likely indicated the presence of one of the pairs of twin suns. But whether they were Sitha and Tano or Patru and Trey, he had no way of discerning. He was very tired. It was already abundantly clear to him that his notion of making his way alone and on foot across the hundreds of miles between Saro City and Omgundo National Park was an absurd fantasy. Damn, Theramun. Together, at least, they might have stood a chance. But the newspaper man had been unshakable in his confidence that he would somehow find Sephira in the forest. Talk about fantasy. Talk about absurdity. Sheeran stared ahead, peering through the fog. He needed a place to rest for a while. He needed to find something fit to eat, and perhaps a change of clothing or at least a way of bathing himself. He had never been this filthy in his life, or as hungry, or as weary, or as despondent. Through the whole long episode of the coming of the darkness, from the first moment that he had heard from Bine and Aethor that such a thing was likely, Sheeran had bounced around from one end of the psychological spectrum to the other, from pessimism to optimism and back again, from hope to despair to hope. His intelligence and experience told him one thing. His naturally resilient personality told him another.
Perhaps Binet and Aethor were wrong and the astronomical cataclysm wouldn't happen at all. No, the cataclysm will definitely happen. Darkness, despite his own disturbing experiences with it at the Tunnel of Mystery 2 years before, would turn out not to be such a troublesome thing after all, if indeed it did come. Wrong. Darkness will cause universal madness. The madness would be only temporary, a brief period of disorientation. The madness will be permanent in most people. The world would be disrupted for a few hours and then go back to normal. The world will be destroyed in the chaos following the eclipse. Back and forth, up and down, twin Sheerans locked in endless debate. But now he had hit the bottom of the cycle, and he seemed to be staying there, unmoving and miserable. His resilience and optimism had evaporated in the glare of what he had seen during his wanderings these past few days. It would be decades, possibly even a century or more, before things returned to normal. The mental trauma had scored too deep a scar. The destruction that had already occurred to the fabric of society was too widespread. The world he had loved had been vanquished by darkness and smashed beyond repair. That was his professional opinion, and he could see no reason to doubt it. This was the third day now since Sheeran had parted from Theramun in the forest and gone marching off in his usual jaunty fashion toward Umgando. That jauntiness was hard to recapture now. He had managed to get out of the forest in one piece. There had been a couple of bad moments, times when he had had to wave his hatchet around and look menacing and lethal, a total bluff on his part, but it had worked, and for the last day or so he had been moving in a plodding way through the once pleasant southern suburbs. Everything was burned out around here. Entire neighborhoods had been destroyed and abandoned. Many of the buildings were still smoldering. The main highway running to the southern provinces, Sheeran had believed, began just a few miles below the park. A couple of minutes' drive, if you were driving. But he wasn't driving. He had had to make the horrendous climb up out of the forest to the imposing hill that was Onos Heights, practically on his hands and knees, clawing his way through the underbrush. It took him half a day just to ascend those few hundred yards. Once he was on top, Sheeran saw that the hill was more like a plateau, but it stretched on endlessly before him, and though he walked and walked and walked, he did not come to the highway. Was he going the right way? Yes. Yes, from time to time he saw a road sign at a street corner that told him he was indeed heading toward the Great Southern Highway. How far was it, though? The signs didn't say. Every 10 or 12 blocks there was another sign, that was all. He kept going. He had no choice. But reaching the highway was only the first step in getting to Umgando. He would still be in Sorrow City, essentially, at that point. Then what? Keep on walking? What else? He could hardly hitch a ride with someone. No vehicles seemed to be running anywhere. The public fuel stations must have gone dry days ago, those that had not been burned. How long was it likely to take him, at this pace, to get down to Umgando on foot? Weeks? Months? No, it would take him forever. He'd be dead of starvation long before he came anywhere near the place. Even so, he had to go on. Without a sense of purpose, he was finished right now, and he knew it. Something like a week had passed since the eclipse, maybe more. He was beginning to lose track of time. He neither ate regularly nor slept regularly anymore, and Sheeran had always been a man of the most punctual habits. Suns came and went in the sky now, the light brightened or dimmed, the air grew warmer or cooler, and time passed. But without the progression of breakfast, lunch, dinner, sleep, Sheeran had no idea of how it was passing. He knew only that he was rapidly running out of strength. He hadn't eaten properly since the coming of the nightfall. From that dark moment onward, it had been scraps and shards for him, nothing more. A bit of fruit from some tree when he could find it. Any unripe seeds that didn't look as though they'd be poisonous. Blades of grass. Anything. It wasn't making him sick somehow, but it wasn't sustaining him very well either. The nutritional content must have been close to zero. His clothes, worn and tattered, hung from him like a shroud. He didn't dare look underneath them. He imagined that his skin must lie now in loose folds over his jutting bones. His throat was dry all the time. His tongue seemed swollen. There was a frightful pounding behind his eyes, and that dull, numb, hollow sensation in his gut all the time. Well, he told himself in his more cheerful moments, there must have been some reason why he had devoted himself so assiduously for so many years to building up such an opulent layer of fat, and now he was learning what that reason was. But his cheerful moments were fewer and farther between every day. Hunger was preying on his spirits, and he realized that he couldn't hold out much longer like this. His body was big. It was accustomed to regular feedings and robust ones. He could live only so long on his accumulated backlog of shirin, and then he would be too weak to pull himself onward. Before long, it would seem simpler just to curl up behind some bush and rest, and rest, and rest. He had to find food, soon. The neighborhood he was moving through now, though deserted like all the rest, seemed a little less devastated than the areas behind him. There had been fires here, too, but not everywhere, and the flames appeared to have jumped randomly past this house and that without harming them. Patiently, Shirin went from one to the next, trying the door of each house that didn't seem to have been seriously damaged. Locked. Every one of them. How fastidious of these people, he thought. How tidy. The world has fallen in around their ears, and they're abandoning their homes in blind terror, running off to the forest, the campus, the city, the gods only knew where, and they take the trouble to lock their houses before they go. As if they mean simply to have a brief holiday during the time of chaos and then go home to their books and their bric-a-brac, their closets full of nice clothing, their gardens, their patios. Or hadn't they realized that everything was over, that the chaos was going to go on and on and on? Perhaps, Shirin thought dismally, they aren't gone at all. They're in there, hiding behind those locked doors of theirs, huddling in the basement the way I did, waiting for things to get normal again. Or else staring at me from the upstairs windows, hoping I'll go away. He tried another door. Another. Another. All locked. No response.
Hey, anybody home? Let me in.
Silence. He stared bleakly at the thick wooden door in front of him. He envisioned the treasures behind it, the food not yet spoiled and waiting to be eaten, the bathtub, the soft bed. And here he was outside with no way of getting in. He felt a little like the small boy in the fable who has been given the magic key to the Garden of the Gods, where fountains of honey flow and gumdrops grow on every bush, but who is too small to reach up and put it in the keyhole. He felt like crying. He realized, then, that he was carrying a hatchet, and he began to laugh. Hunger must have been making him simple-minded. The little boy in the fable perseveres, offering his mittens and his boots and his velvet cap to various animals who are passing by, so that they will help him. Each one gets on another one's back, and he climbs on the top of the heap and puts the key in the keyhole. And here was not-so-little Shirin, staring at a locked door, and he was holding a hatchet. Break the door down? Just break it down? It went against everything that he thought was right and proper. Shirin looked at the hatchet as though it had turned to a serpent in his hand. Breaking in, why, that was burglary. How could he, Shirin 501, professor of psychology at Saro University, simply smash down the door of some law-abiding citizen's house and casually help himself to whatever he found there? Easily, he told himself, laughing even harder at his own foolishness. This is how you do it. He swung the hatchet. But it wasn't all that easy. His starvation-weakened muscles rebelled at the effort. He could lift the hatchet all right, and he could swing it. But the blow seemed pathetically weak, and a line of fire shot through his arms and back as the blade made contact with the stout wooden door. Had he split the door? No. Cracked it a little? Maybe. Maybe a little chip. He swung again. Again. Harder. There you go, Shirin. You're getting the hang of it now. Swing. Swing. He scarcely felt the pain after the first few swings. He closed his eyes, pulled breath deep into his lungs and swung again. The door was cracking now. There was a perceptible crevice. Another swing. Another. Maybe five or six more good blows and it would break in half. Food. Bath. Bed. Swing. And swing. And the door opened in his face. He was so astonished that he nearly fell through. He staggered and lurched, braced himself with the haft of the axe against the doorframe, and looked up. Half a dozen fierce, wild-eyed faces looked back at him.
"You knocked, sir,"
a man said, and everyone howled in manic glee. Then they reached out for him, caught him by his arms, and pulled him inside.
"You won't be needing this," someone said, and effortlessly twisted the hatchet from Shirin's grasp. "You can only hurt yourself with a thing like that, don't you know?"
More laughter, a crazed howling.
They pushed him into the center of the room and formed a ring around him. There were 7, 8, maybe 9 of them, men and women both, and one half-grown boy. Shirin could see at a glance that they weren't the rightful residents of this house, which must have been neat and well-maintained before they moved into it. Now there were stains on the wall, half the furniture was overturned, there was a sodden puddle of something, wine, on the carpet. He knew what these people were. They were squatters, rough and ragged-looking, unshaven, unwashed. They had come drifting in, had taken possession of the place after its owners fled. One of the men was wearing only a shirt. One of the women, hardly more than a girl, was clad in just a pair of shorts. They all had an acrid, repellent odor. Their eyes had that intense, rigid, off-center look that he had seen 1,000 times in recent days. You didn't need any clinical experience to know that those were the eyes of the insane. Cutting through the stink of the squatters' bodies, though, was another odor, a much more pleasing one, one that almost drove Shirin out of his mind, too. The aroma of cooking food. They were preparing a meal in the next room. Soup? Stew? Something was boiling in there. He swayed, dizzied by his own hunger and the sudden hope of soothing it at last. Mildly, he said, I didn't know the house was occupied, but I hope you'll let me stay with you this evening, and then I'll be moving along.
You from the patrol?
A big, heavily bearded man asked suspiciously. He seemed to be the leader. Shirin said uncertainly,
The patrol? No, I don't know anything about them. My name is Shirin 501, and I'm a member of the faculty of...
Patrol! 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 They were chanting suddenly, moving in a circle around him.
Sorrow University, he finished.
It was as though he had uttered a magic spell. They halted in their tracks as his quiet voice cut through their shrill screaming, and they fell silent, staring at him in a terrifying way.
You see, you're from the university?
The leader asked in a strange tone.
That's right, a department of psychology. I'm a teacher, and I do a little hospital work on the side. Look, I don't intend to make any trouble for you at all. I just need a place to rest for a few hours and a little food, if you can spare it. Just a little. I haven't eaten since...
University!
A woman cried. The way she said it, it sounded like something filthy, something blasphemous. Shirin had heard that tone before from Philemon 66, the night of the eclipse, referring to scientists. It was a frightening thing to hear.
University! University! University!
They began to circle around him again, chanting again, pointing at him, making bizarre signs with their hooked fingers. He could no longer understand their words. It was a raucous, nightmare chant, nonsense syllables. Were these people some subchapter of the Apostles of Flame, convening here to practice an arcane rite? No, he doubted that. They had a different look. Too ragged, too shabby, too demented. The apostles, such few of them as he had seen, had always appeared crisp, self-contained, almost frighteningly controlled. Besides, the apostles hadn't been in evidence since the eclipse. Shirin supposed that they had all withdrawn to some sanctuary of their own to enjoy the vindication of their beliefs in private. These people, he thought, were simply unaffiliated, wandering crazies. And it seemed to Shirin that he saw murder in their eyes.
Listen, he said, if I've disturbed some ceremony of yours in any way, I apologize, and I'm perfectly willing to leave right now. I only tried to come in here because I thought the house was empty, and I was so hungry. I didn't mean to...
University! University!
He had never seen a look of such intense hatred as these people were giving him. But there was fear there, too. They kept back from him, tense, trembling as if in dread of some terrible power that he might unexpectedly unleash. Shirin held his hands out to them imploringly. If only they'd stop prancing and chanting for a moment. The smell of the food cooking in the next room was making him wild. He caught one of the women by the arm, hoping to halt her long enough to appeal to her for a crust, a bowl of broth, anything. But she jumped away, hissing as though Shirin had burned her with his touch, and rubbed frantically at the place on her arm where his fingers had briefly rested.
Please, he said, I don't intend any harm. I'm as harmless as anyone there is, believe me.
Harmless, the leader cried, spitting the word out. You? You, university? You're worse than the patrol. The patrol just makes a little trouble for people, but you... You destroyed the world.
I what?
Be careful, Tussibar, a woman said. Get him out of here before he makes a magic on us.
A magic?
Shirin said.
Me?
They were pointing at him again, stabbing the air vehemently, terrifyingly. Some had begun to chant under their breaths, a low, fierce chant that had the rhythms of a motor steadily gaining speed and soon to spin out of control. The girl, who wore only a pair of shorts, said,
"It was the university that called down the darkness on us."
"And the stars," said the man who just wore a shirt. "They brought the stars."
"And this one might bring them back," said the woman who had spoken before. "Get him out of here! Get him out of here!"
Sheeran stared incredulously. He told himself that he should have been able to predict this. It was an all-too-likely development, pathological suspicion of all scientists, all educated people, an unreasoning phobia that must be raging now like a virus among the survivors of the night of terror.
"Do you think I can bring back the stars with a snap of my fingers? Is that what's frightening you?"
"You are university," the man called Tassibar said. "You knew the secrets. University brought the darkness. Yes, university brought the stars. University brought doom."
It was too much. Bad enough to be dragged in here and forced to inhale the maddening flavor of that food without being allowed to have any of it. But to be blamed for the catastrophe, to be looked upon as some sort of malevolent witch by these people. Something snapped in Sheeran. Derisively, he cried,
"Is that what you believe? You idiots! You deranged, superstitious fools! Blaming the university? We brought the darkness? By all the gods, what stupidity! We were the very ones who tried to warn you!"
He gestured angrily, clenching his fists, clashing them furiously together.
"He's going to bring them again, Tassibar! He'll make it go dark on us! Stop him! Stop him!"
Suddenly they were clustering all about him, closing in, reaching for him. Sheeran, standing in their midst, held out his hands helplessly, apologetically toward them, and did not try to move. He regretted having insulted them just now, not because it had endangered his life, they probably hadn't even paid attention to the names he was calling them, but because he knew that the way they were was not their fault. If anything, it was his fault for not having tried harder to help them protect themselves against what he knew was coming. Those articles of pheromones, if only he had spoken with the newspaper man, if only he had urged him in time to change his mocking tack. Yes, he regretted that now. He regretted all sorts of things, things both done and undone. But it was much too late. Someone punched him. He gasped in surprise and pain.
"Lilith!"
he managed to cry. Then they swarmed all over him. 36. There were four suns in the sky. Onos, Dovim, Patru, Trey. Four sun days were supposed to be lucky ones, Theremin remembered, and certainly this one was. Meat. Actual meat at last. What a glorious sight. It was food that he had obtained strictly by accident. But that was all right. The novel charms of outdoor life had been wearing thinner and thinner for him the hungrier he got. By now, he'd gladly take his meat any way it came, thank you very much. The forest was full of all sorts of wild animals, most of them small, very few of them dangerous, and all of them impossible to catch, at least with your bare hands. And Theremin knew nothing about making traps, nor did he have anything out of which he might have fashioned one. Those children's tales about people lost in the woods who immediately set about adapting to life in the open and turn instantly into capable hunters and builders of dwelling places were just that, fables. Theremin regarded himself as a reasonably competent man, as city dwellers went, but he knew that he had no more chance of hunting down any of the forest animals than he did of making the municipal power generators start to work again. And as for building a dwelling place, the best he had been able to do was throw together a simple lean-to of branches and twigs, which at least had kept most of the rain away from him on one stormy day. But now the weather was warm and lovely again, and he had actual meat for dinner. The only problem now was cooking it. He was damned if he was going to eat it raw. Ironic that in a city that had just undergone near total destruction by fire, he should be pondering how he was going to go about cooking some meat. But most of the worst fires had burned themselves out by now, and the rain had taken care of the rest. And though for a while in the first few days after the catastrophe, it had seemed as though new fires were still being lit, that didn't seem to be happening anymore. "I'll figure something out," Theremin thought. "Rub two sticks together and get a spark. Strike metal against stone and set a scrap of cloth ablaze." Some boys on the far side of a lake near the place where he was camped had obligingly killed the animal for him. Of course, they hadn't known they were doing him any favor. Most likely they had been planning to eat it themselves, unless they were so unhinged that they were simply chasing the creature for the sake of sport. Somehow he doubted that. They had been pretty purposeful about it, with a single-mindedness that only hunger can inspire. The beast was a Graben, one of those ugly, long-nosed, bluish-furred things with slithery, hairless tails that sometimes could be seen poking around suburban garbage cans after Onos had set. Well, beauty wasn't a requirement just now. The boys had somehow flushed it out of its daytime hiding place and had driven the poor, stupid thing into a little dead-end box of a canyon. As Theremin watched from the other side of the lake, disgusted and envious at the same time, they chased it tirelessly up and down, pelting it with rocks. For a dumb scavenger, it was remarkably agile, scooting swiftly this way and that in its desperation to elude its attackers. But finally, a lucky shot caromed off its head and killed it instantly. He had assumed that they would devour it on the spot, but at that moment, a shaggy, shambling figure came into view above them, standing for a moment at the rim of the little canyon, then beginning to climb down toward the lake.
"Run! It's Garpik the Slasher!"
one of the boys yelled.
"Garpik! Garpik!"
In an instant, the boys scattered, leaving the dead Graben behind. Theremin, still watching, had slipped back into the shadows on his side of the lake. He also knew this Garpik, though not by name. One of the most dreaded of the forest dwellers, a squat, almost ape-like man who wore nothing but a belt through which an assortment of knives was thrust. He was a killer without motive, a cheerful psychopath, a pure predator. Garpik stood by the mouth of the canyon for a while, humming to himself, fondling one of his knives. He didn't seem to notice the dead animal or didn't care. Perhaps he was waiting for the boys to come back, but plainly they weren't planning to do that. And after a time, Garpik, with a shrug, went slouching off into the forest, most likely in search of something amusing to do with his weapons. Theremin waited an endless moment, making certain Garpik didn't intend to double back and pounce on him. Then, when he could no longer bear the sight of the dead Graben laying there on the ground, where some other human or animal predator might suddenly come along to seize it before he did, he rushed forward, circled the lake, snatched the animal up, and carried it back to his hiding place. It weighed as much as a small child. It might be good for two or three meals or more, if he could restrain his hunger and if the meat didn't spoil too quickly. His head was spinning with hunger. He had had nothing but fruits and nuts to eat for more days than he could remember. His skin had drawn tight over his muscles and bone. What little spare fat he had been carrying, he had long since absorbed, and now he was consuming his own strength in the struggle to stay alive. But this evening, at last, he would enjoy a little feast. Roast Graben. What a treat, he thought bitterly. And then he thought, be grateful for small mercies, Theremin. Let's see. To build a fire now. Fuel first. Behind his shelter was a flat wall of rock with a deep lateral crack in it, in which a line of weeds was growing. Plenty of them were long dead and withered, and had dried out since the last rainstorm. Quickly, Theremin moved along the rock wall, plucking yellowed stems and leaves, assembling a little heap of straw-like material that would catch fire easily. Now some dry twigs. They were harder to find, but he rummaged around the forest floor, looking for dead shrubs, or at least shrubs with dead branches. The afternoon was well along by the time he had put together enough of that sort of tinder to matter. Dovim was gone from the sky. Trey and Patru, which had been low on the horizon when the boys were hunting the Graben, now had moved into the center of things, like a pair of glittering eyes watching the sorry events on Kelgash from far overhead. Carefully, Theremin arranged his kindling wood above the dried plants, building a framework as he imagined a real outdoorsman would, the bigger branches along the outside, then the thinner ones crisscrossed over the middle. Not without some difficulty, he skewered the Graben on a spit he had made of a sharp, reasonably straight stick, and positioned it a short distance above the woodpile. So far, so good. Just one little thing missing now. Fire. He had kept his mind away from that problem while assembling his fuel, hoping that it would solve itself somehow without his having to dwell on it. But now it had to be faced. He needed a spark. The old boys' book trick of rubbing two sticks together was, Theremin was certain, nothing but a myth. He had read that certain primitive tribes had once started their fires by twirling a stick against a board with a little hole in it. But he suspected that the process wasn't all that simple, that it probably took an hour of patient twirling to get anything going. And in any case, very likely you had to be initiated into the art by the old man of the tribe when you were a boy, or some such thing, or it wouldn't work. Two rocks, though. Was it possible to strike a spark by banging one against the other? He doubted that, too. But he might as well try it, he thought. He had no other ideas. There was a wide, flat stone lying nearby. and after searching, he found a smaller, triangular one that could fit conveniently in the palm of his hand. He knelt beside his little fireplace and began methodically to hit the flat one with the pointed one. Nothing in particular happened. A hopeless feeling began to grow in him.